Namo tassa bhagavato arahato sammāsambuddhassa. Namo tassa bhagavato arahato sammāsambuddhassa. Namo tassa bhagavato arahato sammāsambuddhassa. Buddhaṃ dhammaṃ saṅghaṃ namassāmi. So I do have a record of the suttas which have been read out, and this one is not on that record, so it's the first time we're reading this sutta out. It is a reasonably simple sutta. There's nothing that profound, except for one little paragraph where they do have a very rare mention of Abhidhamma, and it gives you an indication of what the Abhidhamma really meant in the time of the Buddha. And even for seeing that, it is a great eye-opener for everybody. But it also, the sutta is about the forest monk. And even though that some commentators say, oh, well, this compares the forest monk to the town-dwelling monk, this must be very late because they assumed all the monks lived in the forest in the time of the Buddha, which is wrong. There is very strong archaeological evidence of big monasteries such as the Jetavana Monastery, the Jeta Grove Monastery outside of Sarvati, or the Bamboo Grove Monastery, which was built very, very close to the city. And being very, very close to the city, it would actually count as a town monastery. The definition of a forest monastery, it has to be at least 1 kilometer from the nearest house by the most nearest path. And if it's more than 1 kilometer away, it's considered to be a forest monastery. And any of you who've been on pilgrimage, and you go into places like the Jetavana or the Bamboo Grove, it won't be more than 1 kilometer away from the city. And these would be some places where the Buddha had his monasteries, and they would be close enough to the city, which meant they get lots and lots of support. And the real forest monks, they would be a long way away from the cities, really, you know, in remote places, which would be more ascetic, and there'll be less people coming to visit. And those would be the forest monks. And this is really what the Buddha's talking about. Even in his time, there'd be most of the monks would be staying close to the teachers in these big monasteries, such as the Jetavana Monastery, the Jeta Grove Monastery outside of Sarvati. There was also the Migaramata Pasada. That was actually built by Vaisakha, the great lay follower. And that was actually means. Migaramata was her nickname. Visakha, her real name was, and Pasada means like a palace. So it was this big 7-story structure which was built for the community of monks in those days. And that was the time of the Buddha, not afterwards. So even in the time of the Buddha, there were very well-constructed monasteries where the Sangha would live, but some monks would either stay some time in those big monasteries, but they'd also stay up in the forest as well, in quite remote places. So this is, even though it mentions the difference between a forest monk and a city-dwelling monk, this is, doesn't mean this is a late sutta, as some commentators assume. That doesn't have any real justification. Because many, many of you have actually seen even ancient carvings of things like Anathapindika giving the Jetavana Monastery to the Buddha. It was a very famous story. So we know that that monastery was there from very, very early days. So anyway, sorry? Yeah, the mic's on. Yeah, it's on. Maybe it's because of the fan you can't hear. So anyway, I'll try and get closer and speak a bit louder. So it should be recorded. Did anyone else not hear? Can you hear at the back? Okay. Can the dog hear? I don't think the dog can hear. No. It is recording, good. Okay. So here we go, the Gaurisāni Sutta. Thus have I heard, this is number 69. On one occasion, a Blessed One was living at Rajagaha in the bamboo grove in the squirrel's sanctuary. And many of you may have been to the bamboo grove just outside Rajagaha when you go on pilgrimage. And it's not that far away from the hot springs. And so that would have been very well visited the bamboo grove. Now, on that occasion, a monk named Gaurisāni, a forest dweller of lax behavior, had come on a visit to stay in the midst of the Sangha for some business or other. So he'd normally stay off by himself, and now he was visiting the big monastery. The Venerable Sariputta addressed the monks with reference to the Bhikkhu Gaudisani thus, "Friends, when a forest-dwelling monk comes to the Sangha and is living in the Sangha, he should be respectful and deferential towards his companions in the holy life. If he is disrespectful and undeferential towards his companions in the holy life, there will be those who would say of him, 'What has this venerable forest dweller gained by his dwelling alone in the forest, doing as he likes, since he is disrespectful and undeferential towards his companions in the holy life?' Since there would be those who say this of him, a forest-dwelling bhikkhu who has come to the Sangha and is living in the Sangha should be respectful and deferential towards his companions in the holy life." And this is very easy for me to understand as being a forest monk and also sometimes going to stay in the city to do visas or for health problems or whatever. And in those days in Thailand, even today, there was a sense of pride amongst the forest-dwelling monks, as if we are superior than the other monks because we live in the forest. But if you are living in the forest, there's so much solitude when you're living in the forest. Even in places like Bodhinyana or Dharamsala, we have our huts away from everywhere, so you can actually live away from other people. So you can, as it says in here, do as you like. No one is watching you. So you can sleep all day if you want to. Now you can just mess around. You don't have to be under the scrutiny of the other monks, as you would be if you're in a very close sangha, or you won't be under the scrutiny of the visiting lay community. So that was one of the dangers of forest monks. Basically, because you were secluded, you could be lazy. And also, that's where it says, doing as you like. Also, they were saying there that they should always be deferential. In another sutta elsewhere, there was a meditating monks were criticizing the study monks. So you're just studying, you know, you don't know sort of anything about the real practice. And the study monks were criticizing the practice monks. Yeah, every time you're meditating, you're going to sleep. And so they were criticizing each other. And it was one of the monks, I think Mahakotita, said, "Look, the study monks should not criticize the meditation monks. The meditation monks should not criticize the study monks. We should be respectful towards each other." And that is really important, because otherwise it's very easy to see in a community of monks, just like in any other community, there can be the arrogance born of a sense of superiority. "Look, I meditate. I'm much better than you other guys who don't meditate. Oh, I study. I'm much more wise and learned than you are." And of course, as you all know, even if you're not even a Buddhist, that such arrogance has nothing to do with Buddhism. And that's why, if you really are interested in that, there's another sutta in this book called the Sapurisa Sutta, where it tells about a monk who keeps his precepts, who starts to be restrained, who develops these deep meditations one after the other. And every time he says he doesn't praise himself and look down upon others, every time he achieves any sort of development in the path, any progress in the path. So you don't praise yourself and look down on others, no matter what you're doing. Even if you're developing good virtue, just because you're virtuous, you don't look down upon those other scallywags who are not. In other words, you know, you just give other people a chance, and actually to start learning. And that instruction, not to be arrogant, not to look down upon others, is a very beautiful part of Buddhism. So this is number 69, Gaudisani Sutta. So it says, even a forest-dwelling monk, you should be deferential and respectful to others, even if they live in a city. So even then, the forest-dwelling monks, you can see over there that sometimes they would be arrogant and think of themselves as superior. And number paragraph 4, when a forest-dwelling monk comes into the Sangha and is living in a Sangha, he should be skilled in good behavior regarding seats. Thus, I shall sit down in such a way that I do not encroach upon elder bhikkhus and do not deny new bhikkhus a seat. If he is not skilled in good behavior regarding seats, there will be those who will say of him, What is venerable forest dweller gained by his dwelling alone in the forest, doing as he likes, since he does not even know what pertains to good behavior? Since there will be those who would say this of him, a forest-dwelling monk who has come to the Sangha and is living in the Sangha should be skilled in a good behavior regarding seats. Again, this refers to the idea of arrogance. The way that the seats are arranged in a Sangha, it doesn't matter how enlightened you are, it doesn't matter how good your meditation is, it doesn't matter how restrained you are, how simple you are. We have this rule that whoever ordained first, they put in a senior seat, and then you go down the line according to when you were ordained. So because I was ordained before Venerable Janaratu, I sit before him in the line. It makes things very easy. Because otherwise, the monks might think, who should sit at the top of the line? I've got first jhana, but I've got sort of stream winning. But I am an expert in all of the suttas. I wrote many books. But I am a great teacher with thousands of disciples. And you can see that sometimes who gets the best seat, it will be an open introduction to arrogance and conceit. And unfortunately, that people actually do fight for those best seats sometimes, to be out front, to be the leader. That's the nature of human beings, to be proud. So, and some others are the opposite of conceit. Obviously self-deprecating. So they always want to sit in the last seat. So even that's wrong. So you just sit according to your, when you're ordained. That makes it very easy. So if I go to a big monastery, I say, when were you ordained? And then when was I ordained? Then I can get my idea where I'm supposed to sit. And it makes it very easy for everybody. So what we'd imagine here, because again, a forest monk, it looks like he was a bit arrogant, he'd probably want to sit at the front. Because also when you sit at the front, if you are arrogant, you get all the attention from people. And so some stupid people want that attention. They must be dumb. So paragraph 5. When a forest-dwelling monk comes to Sangha, is living in the Sangha, he should not enter the village too early or return late in the day. This is when he goes for alms round. If he enters the village too early and returns late in the day, there will be those who would say of him, what has this venerable forest-dweller gained by his dwelling alone in the forest, doing as he likes? Since he enters the village too early and returns late in the day. Since there will be those who would say this of him, a forest-dwelling monk who has come to the Sangha and is living in the Sangha should not enter the village too early or return late in the day. And of course, that refers to on the alms round. If you go too early, I mean, especially it's still dark, people don't know, what are you doing so early in the morning? There was a case of this monk who went on alms round in the middle of the night. And it was very dark. And this woman was going out to do some washing or whatever, and there was a flash of lightning. And that's when she saw this monk. That's the first time she saw his face, when there's a flash of lightning illuminated him. And she thought it was a devil. And she said, my mother is dead, my father is dead, there's a devil after me. And he said, I'm not a devil, I'm only a monk. And she said, you stupid monk, you shouldn't be out this time in the morning or this middle of the night when people can't see you. You scare the life out of me. So it's obviously for reasons of just a night time in the time of the Buddha, people are up to all sorts of mischief. So because of that, you go after the light comes up. And you don't sort of spend too much time in there, because when you're out into the village asking for alms food, the lay people have to look after you. So they come and cook for you, or they come and give you something. And if you're out there all day, they're having to cook for you all the time, or if you're not got the right time, then it makes it very difficult for the lay community to do all their other jobs. So one of the things I was really taught as a monk, as a forest monk, you're not supposed to be overburdening the people who look after you. So you go at a certain time on the alms round, you come out afterwards. So you're not much of a burden. They know when you're coming, oh, this is the monk coming. And then you come back afterwards. And how many of you have been waiting for, say, a tradesman, an electrician, or a plumber to come to your house to fix something? And they say they're coming at 9 o'clock. And you wake at 9 o'clock, 9:30, 10 o'clock, 10:30, 11 o'clock, and they come about 1 o'clock in at lunchtime. They never call you up. And that's just a big hindrance to your day. You're waiting around for these people. That's just like the monks. If you're coming for alms round, you've got to be on time. So a forest dwelling bhikkhu, because he's been able to do things by himself, do whatever he likes, no one to tell him what to do, that's why he can get a bit sloppy on such things. And please interrupt if there's anything interesting you want to say. This is much about the what happens when you're a monk, but sometimes it's good you understand these things so you can keep us honest. When a forest dwelling monk comes to Sangha and is living in a Sangha, he should not go before the meal or after the meal to visit the families. If he goes before the meal or after the meal to visit families, it will be those who say of him, surely this venerable forest dwelling, while dwelling alone in the forest, doing as he likes, must be used to making untimely visits, since he behaves thus when he has come to the Sangha. Since it will be those who would say this of him, a forest dwelling monk who has come to the Sangha and is living in a Sangha should not go before the meal or after the meal to visit families. Now this is when you invite the monks to your house for the meal, as we do these days. So there may be some sort of ceremony, or you know, you want to do a blessing, or someone's getting married or dead or whatever, moving to a new house. There's all these little ceremonies you invite the monks to the house. And this is from the time of the Buddha. And so sometimes the monks, they would go by themselves. Not these days, when everyone passes into a car and off we go together. They would actually make their own way there. So imagine what would happen. You know, if Venerable Jana Ratona was already there and he was waiting for me and I was just visiting someone else and talking to them and got caught up in conversations, you know what it's like, have another cup of tea, another photograph, please can you sign my books? I've got another question on meditation. And you get caught up on that and you arrive late and everyone has to wait for you. And of course, that's very disrespectful. And it's also afterwards, after the meal, if you just go visiting this person and that person, that people don't know where you are. And it's also important that you know, in any community, we know where each other is. If someone comes to visit you, if there's a bushfire or something in our monastery, we have to know where people are. Otherwise, we go looking for them, and you know, they're still in town somewhere visiting someone. So this was, again, another sign that those forest monks, or that particular forest monks, because he was living alone by himself, he didn't have the sensitivity to others, which you learn in a community. And it's the sensitivity to what other people are doing. So you're not just thinking about yourself. You're realizing how your actions and how your behavior is affecting others. Again, that's one of the problems of being a hermit. You don't live with other people, and you forget these simple things of life, simple etiquette. 7. When a forest-dwelling monk comes to the Sangha and is living in a Sangha, he should not be haughty and personally vain. If he was haughty and personally vain, there'll be those who would say of him, surely this venerable forest dweller, while dwelling alone in the forest, doing as he likes, must be generally be haughty and personally vain, since he behaves thus when he comes to the Sangha. Since it would be those who would say this of him, a forest-dwelling monk who has come to the Sangha, is living in the Sangha, should not be haughty and personally vain. And again, this is some of the problems of what we call, or what was called by, there was a Tibetan monk, he was a very good writer, but some of his personal behavior left much to be desired. He ended up sort of in a rehab with alcohol poisoning, that's what killed him. But nevertheless, he was the one who coined the term spiritual materialism. And spiritual materialism is when a person, it could be a monk, a nun, a layman, a laywoman, practicing, where you actually do develop some knowledge, some understanding of Buddhism, and you do get some, you keep your precepts, you're a good person, you keep 8 precepts maybe on the moon days, and maybe you got some decent meditation. It's so easy to get arrogant and proud. Even if you don't express it to other people, sometimes you can look down upon others. Oh, those other Buddhists, they never actually keep the precepts. They come every Friday night, and as soon as they listen to the talk, they go to the pub or they go to the nightclub and they mess around. They're not sort of real good Buddhists. And that's actually, by putting other people down, it shows that you're getting a bit proud. And that's not part of Buddhism, putting other people down. And having lived in the forest tradition for many times, I saw many, many times people really putting down the monks who lived in the city. Just because they lived in the city, they couldn't have been real good monks. And even just the robe colors we wear, we just wear this dark brown colored robe. And if you ever go to Thailand, you see most of the monks wear these bright orange robes. And they think, those bright orange robes, monks, they just all keep money, they just all probably watch the TV, They just don't meditate. They just go on trying to get money and doing ceremonies. They're hopeless monks. That's arrogance. And the story which I remember, which was a very good story, which all the monks of my tradition should remember. Once there was this young monk came to stay at Wat Pa Pong when Ajahn Chah was still alive and teaching. But he wore the yellow robes of the town monks. And so all the other monks, you know, the forest monks there, they looked down upon him and said, what does he know? He's hopeless. So he stayed there for 3 days and no one took any interest in him whatsoever. And after a while, he just went back again. And one of our monks met him some years later and was talking to him. Said, oh, yeah, I went to Wat Pa Pong because, you know, I got into the third jhana. I just couldn't make any more progress into the fourth jhana. So I went there to ask for some advice. And now most of those monks in the forest can't get even that far. No, even first jhana. And there was a really, really good monk, a great meditator. And because of the color of his robes, everyone assumed he was hopeless and he wasn't really worth talking to. That was another case of spiritual arrogance. So just because a person wears the robe of a town-dwelling monk, or just because, you know, he's not the same tradition as you are or whatever, that does not mean he's not a good monk. And so forest monks, because they're very strict and ascetic, you can have that spiritual materialism, the pride born of austerity and asceticism. And he's saying here, you should not, even if you're a forest dweller, you should not be vain and haughty. Pride has nothing to do with this path. Is that okay to you? And please, don't you ever do that. Don't ever, you know, you meet another person. What tradition are you from? Oh, I'm from, you know, the Vajrayana tradition. Oh, they're just into too many rituals. You know, we're into the real Theravada. This is the original Buddhism. What part of Theravada are you from? Now, we're from the Thai forest tradition. Oh, I'm from the Burmese. Oh, the Burmese tradition. They're too much into Abhidhamma. They don't know what they're talking about. Don't ever do things like that, because we respect all people, even non-Buddhists. So be careful of spiritual materialism. Never be haughty and vain. Just because, you know, you might think, oh, we've got the best teacher. I hope you think that. No, I don't. So be careful of that spiritual materialism. So, where we go. Number 8. When a forest-dwelling monk comes to the Sangha and is living in the Sangha, he should not be rough-tongued and loose-spoken. If he is rough-tongued and loose-spoken, there will be those who would say of him, what has this venerable forest dweller gained by his dwelling alone in the forest, doing as he likes, since he is rough-tongued and loose-spoken? Since there will be those who would say of him thus, a forest-dwelling bhikkhu has come to the Sangha and is living in the Sangha, should not be rough-tongued and loose-spoken. Now again, I understand all of these, because I've been a monk for a long time, and sometimes, you know what would happen? You get some monks, and when I was a young monk in Thailand, they'd be living alone for like months. And as soon as they come to say Wat Nana Chartwa, I spent a lot of time, they would just be talking, because that's the first time they'd met a Western monk for weeks and months. And I said, look, it's all right for you, you know, I've had all this solitude, but please, you know, don't sort of unload all your verbal baggage on me. Because they just wanted to talk, because they'd been silent for a long time. But really, they were just so obnoxious. So look, you know, we also want to practice meditation, so just be quiet for goodness sake. So I could also see that when a person's been alone for a long time, sometimes they just like talking a lot, because it's just a reaction to the silence which they have had. And it's very easy to be rough-tongued when you're by yourself, because whenever we're in company, and if ever I say something wrong, you'd actually look at me or you'll criticize me, and I could see straight away, uh-oh, I've said something wrong, I've been too rough, and I get feedback straight away. But when you're alone in the forest, you know, some of the thoughts you have, you don't get any feedback. So it's very easy when you're living alone in solitude, you know, to get a little bit off, because you don't have the feedback which you get from social interactions. So it's quite easy to understand how a person who's been in solitude can be actually very rough. Now, afterwards, a lot of time they don't realize what they're saying. So these are things which I can understand. I've experienced these things. And I've probably done the same myself. I don't know. I hope not. When a forest-dwelling monk comes to Sangha and is living in a Sangha, he should be easy to correct and should associate with good friends. If he is difficult to correct and associates with bad friends, there will be those who would say of him, What has this venerable forest dweller gained by his dwelling alone in the forest, doing as he likes, since he is difficult to correct and associates with bad friends? Since there will be those who would say this of him, a forest-dwelling monk who has come to the Sangha, who is living in the Sangha, should be easier to correct and should associate with good friends. Again, this is about humility again. And easy to correct means we all make mistakes. And so it's part of our tradition in a monastery. If somebody makes a mistake, then the other monks, if they don't see it for themselves, will gently point it out. That's venerable. That's not the right way to do it. You should do it this way and don't do it that way. And again, the example of that, the great humility, which is one example which I always remember, was when Sariputta, the senior, the wisest disciple, according to the sayings of the Buddha, the wisest disciple next to the Buddha himself, he was going on alms round one morning, and his robe was not properly put on. And this small novice monk came up to him and said, "Venerable sir, your robe is a mess." Now, Sariputta was this enlightened monk, number two to the Buddha, just about. Big shot. And this was a tiny little novice who said this to him. And Sariputta didn't say, "Who are you to tell me? Get away, you little squirt, you incompetent person." Instead, what he did, even though he was being admonished by just a young novice, he decided to look to see if there was anything to little criticism. He found, my goodness, it was right. My robes aren't properly put on. So he quickly went behind a bush, put his robes back on again, came out again, and then he put his hands up to the novice and said, "Thank you, teacher." And he called him teacher. Now that was a beautiful humility, big monk, so wise, enlightened, and that was probably a novice who didn't know very much at all. Nevertheless, thank you for correcting me. Thank you for criticizing me. And it's a wonderful thing if we can do that. So look, the next time your wife points out some mistake in you, please tell her, "Oh, thank you, teacher. Thank you, Ajahn." Instead of saying, "Oh, you'd say that about me. Now let me tell you what you're doing wrong." So you can see the problems there. So in the Sangha, it's supposed to be accepting of correction because humility is important. And of course, you can understand when a person lives alone, sometimes they don't learn those beautiful behaviors of living with people. And again, not associating with bad friends. Number 10. Now, when a forest-dwelling monk should guard the doors of his sense faculties. If he does not guard the doors of his sense faculties, there will be those who would say of him, "What is this venerable forest dwelling gained by his dwelling alone in the forest, doing as he likes, since he does not guard the doors of his sense faculties?" Since there be those who would say this of him, a forest dwelling monk should guard the doors of his sense faculties. And that is part of the training, which is one of the nice reasons why we read a sutta like this. It brings up the gradual training, the full training of everybody. We actually restrain our senses. So we don't go looking around all over the place. We don't go listening to what that person is saying. No, we don't indulge our senses. And the problem is, when you're in the forest, there's nothing much to look at. One tree looks the same as another after a while, and there's not much to listen to. But you go into the city, and wow, there's all these shopping centers, and all this activity, and all these people in their fine clothes, and all this amazing food. And you can understand how a person who has lived in austere circumstances could go wild once they see all these amazing sights and sounds and smells, tastes and touches in the city. And so he said, now listen, even though you had an easy sense restraint in the forest because there was nothing much to disturb the senses, if you haven't really trained, then when you go into the town, into the big monasteries, you will actually lose it. So be careful. Your sense restraint should be practiced, not just when you're in the forest, but even more so when you're in the town. And again, you have seen people like that. People have been so austere, so ascetic, that the pleasures or the sights and the sounds of the village or the town, they just blow you away.
Exactly.
That's a very, very good point. Because real sense restraint, it's a gentle training, but not at the expense of all the other trainings. Because sometimes we can focus on one thing and forget everything else. It gets unbalanced. So a lot of that sense restraint, which people do and they get miserable, is just controlling and becoming control freaks. And a lot of time, especially with young people in the monastery or people just starting out in the monastery, there's so much competition there and just wondering what other people think of you and fear as well. So it's coming from the wrong place. So real sense restraint is when you put your eyes down, you don't hang out with people that much, because when you're hanging out with each other, that's when you're going to get chatting. And you've been in that monastery a lot. You know that some of the conversations which go on in that monastery, I'm glad they're not recorded. I'd be so embarrassed about some of the things these monks get to talk about after a while. But it's just the monks being the monks, having a bit of fun and games. That's fair enough. But as long as it's not too much. And sometimes it gets over much. And when people get into being overly controlled, overly restrained, they get that sort of that negativity. And one of the fiercest of the monks in Thailand, he just died recently, Lungtao Mahabua. I had the good fortune that after 5 years staying with Ajahn Chah, he asked everybody just to leave the monastery for a year or two, go on this wandering. And one of the things I did there was not just find solitude for myself and live in the real forest where there's no one around for miles, but also go and visit the other teachers. To compare with Ajahn Chah. How did Ajahn Chah teach? How did Ajahn Mahabua teach? How did those other people teach? And the one thing which Ajahn Mahabua is the fiercest of all the monks, the strictest. But then the first day I went there, there was a tea time and all the monks were having tea. And then Ajahn Mahabua came in. And I thought, what's going to happen next? And he just sat down and he started telling jokes. And that was totally what I did not expect from a monk like that. And he said, no, this is a time to relax. And you'd be meditating, you'd be doing a sense retreat. Now this is like just family time. We're just like brothers. And it was such a pleasant thing to see there that even this fierce monk, Ajahn Mahabua, would sit down, he was laughing and telling jokes and funny stories to the monks. It's just like being friends. And that sort of really influenced the way I run a monastery as well. It's, to have sense restraint, but don't overdo it. Otherwise, what you say is actually true. It's not real sense restraint. It's just control and fear. That doesn't work, as you obviously know. But too much. Find a middle way. Exactly. That when they're in the kitchen in Bodhinyana Monastery, practicing sense restraint doesn't mean not talking to people, not interacting. It's good to interact with kindness and generosity. Not to overreact and really get involved and ask all sorts of questions of people and just have long conversations after the meal is finished. But just interact a little bit, be kind. Because as a monk, we get fed and get fed the most amazing food. And I've got incredible gratitude to all the people who feed us. And sometimes you can very easily, as a monk, or as a novice Anagarika nun, you can get the feeling of entitlement. They're entitled to this food. And we're not. This is the generosity of lay people. If we're entitled, when we say, you brought the wrong food today, bring some other food. This is not the food I like. Bring something else. As if, that you're our slaves, that you have to do this. So always make sure you don't feel that entitlement to anything. So that means you're kind to these people and you value them and you're grateful that they come. How long have you been coming every Friday for such a long time? That's really amazing, Rodney. I really respect you a lot. So that's how we are. We have sense restraint, but we don't go over the top. Number 11. A forest dwelling monk should be moderate in eating. If he's not moderate in eating, there'll be those who say of him, what is this venerable forest dweller gained by his dwelling alone in the forest, doing as he likes, since he's not moderate in eating? Since there'll be those who would say this of him, a forest dwelling bhikkhu should be moderate in eating. And again, this refers to when you stay in the forest, you don't get much good food at all. And so again, when you go and stay in a sort of the big monastery in town, it's very easy to use the modern vernacular for the forest monks to pig out, because it's just more delicious food. That's one of the problems. Living in a forest is further away, harder for the lay community to come and feed you, so you get no worse food, more simple food. And you go to the big monasteries, especially here where the Buddha was staying, and you get all this amazing rich food. So it's very easy to overeat. So he's saying, be careful, be moderate in eating. It doesn't mean to sort of not eat at all, but just the right amount. And actually this is one of the reflections which the monks do. Actually it's about time we talk more about this in Bodhidharma Monastery, because when I was in Hong Kong, the monk was chanting this every time we had a meal, which is, wisely reflecting, we use this alms food, not for fun, not for fattening, not for gratification, only for the maintenance of this body, for keeping it healthy, for living the holy life, thinking this, I will allay hunger without overeating, so that I can may live comfortably, blamelessly, and at ease. That's a little chant, that's the English translation of that. And that's actually what we reflect upon before we eat. And actually, that in monastery, before I ring the bell, that's what I chant to myself every time. Wisely reflecting, I use this alms food, not for fun, not for fattening, not for beautification, only for the maintenance and health of this body. Only for the maintenance and preservation of this body, for keeping it healthy. Thinking thus, I will allay hunger without overeating. Thus I may live blamelessly and at ease. That's called moderation in eating. And a forest-dwelling monk should be devoted to wakefulness. If he's not devoted to wakefulness, there'll be those who would say, what has this venerable forest dweller gained by dwelling alone in the forest, doing as he likes? This is not devoted to wakefulness. Since there'll be those who would say this of him, a forest-dwelling monk should be devoted to wakefulness. And again, if you're staying in a forest, no one is seeing you, so you can sleep all day. And actually, that's one of the reasons why in the early years at Ajahn Chah's monastery, there were just people would stay in their forest, stay in their huts, and we'd only sort of see each other, on arms round, obviously, and for the meal we'd be taken together, and the rest of the day you wouldn't see each other. And so, you know, he didn't know what was going on when people were back in their huts, because most of the time you're by yourself. It was like a community of hermits who'd only meet together for the meal and the arms round. And he found out that a lot of the monks were sleeping all the time, and that's when he started organizing, instituting, you know, the bell at 3 a.m. in the morning, and chanting and meditating together, so at least it gets the monks out of their hut early in the morning so they can meditate. But before, in the early days, there was no sort of bells, nothing like that at all. So sometimes it can be too much of a temptation when no one's looking at you, just to, you know, sit down and sleep, or lay down and sleep, rather. So he was saying that, you know, when your forest-dwelling monk comes into the city, you know, actually that's when they find out what he's been doing in the forest. Very easy when no one's on your back, no one's checking up on you, to indulge in sleep. So asking the forest-dwelling monks to be devoted to wakefulness. A forest-dwelling monk should be energetic. If he is not energetic, there'll be those who would say of him, what is this venerable forest-dweller gained by his dwelling alone in the forest, doing as he likes, since he is lazy? Since there'll be those who would say this of him, a forest-dwelling monk should be energetic. I know in the early years of Bodhidharma Monastery, a lot of people got faith in the monks of that monastery because they saw how hard we worked, building the place. And they realized, well, these monks aren't lazy. And some of the monks they knew from their own home countries were very lazy. They wouldn't do much at all. And then they saw that these monks over in Perth, they were actually really just working their butts off to, you know, build their monasteries and do all this other stuff. And that was actually one of the reasons why we had an early spurt of growth, because they thought, these aren't lazy monks. We want to support this. Because, who wants to support a lazy person? And, you think that, my goodness, I work so hard. I have to go to work, go to work at 8 o'clock in the morning, 9 o'clock in the morning, and these monks have it so easy. Why should I support them? They should be supporting me, the lazy bums. But once you actually see that they are actually working hard, that gives you faith and say, okay, that these monks are really working hard, so we want to support them. So, again, it should not be lazy. Although yesterday, in the meditation, I said that, you should be lazy, but that was a different thing. What I meant by lazy in meditation is that's when you absolutely do absolutely nothing. Don't even think.
Now that's real laziness, to be actually so lazy, you're so still, you don't do anything. But that's not really what we mean lazy. It was just using that word in an unfamiliar context in meditation. Because that's actually how you get very still in meditation. So you have to be energetic. Get up early, go to bed late. And that's why if any of you come on the retreats, it's actually written on the retreat schedules now. And I saw this again when I gave a retreat even in Hong Kong. They pinched it from our schedule. Now, whenever the time the morning rise is, rise up with gusto. And sometimes people ask question, who is this gusto person? But what it meant was like rise up with energy. Put energy in the beginning of the day. So when you get out of bed, you jump up, zippity-doo-dah, another wonderful day, yeah, yeah, yeah. And then look at the clock. My God, 2 o'clock in the morning, I should have got up too early. No, just get up. So that's like developing energy. 14. Oh, does anyone want to interrupt me with anything? No, okay. 14. A forest dwelling monk should be established in mindfulness. If he is unmindful, there'll be those who would say of him, what has his venerable forest dweller gained by his dwellings alone in the forest, doing as he likes, since he's unmindful? Since there'll be those who would say this of him, a forest dwelling monk should be established in mindfulness. And I mean, that's obvious there, but sometimes again, it can be a bit too easy in the forest, so at least you should be mindful and aware of what you're doing and what you're saying and the results it has on other people, aware of other people's body language, aware, even mindful of when you're sort of talking to them, whether you're imposing on them, whether it's time to sort of back off. I remember my cousin, he was actually a salesman for most of his life. And when I was talking to him, he was actually saying, like as a salesman, he was a very successful salesman, I think sell all sorts of goods, I think white goods for some company, like actually being the representative and selling it to the shops, you know, wholesale. And he said he had to be very, very mindful. He'd go into the shop and he had to be really aware whether it was the right time to speak to that manager. If the manager was in a bad mood, he was very busy, he'd say, sorry, I'll come back another time. Because otherwise, you know, if you upset, you know, your clients, then they won't ever have a sale. And so he was actually got very skilled, you know, in knowing people's body language, knowing people's moods, and being so sensitive that if it was the wrong time, even if he had an appointment, say, no, I'll come back later on. He could see that person was really busy or they were tired. And that's actually, you know, how monks should behave also. That sometimes we come and talk to you and have a look at you and see, no, it's the wrong time to ask you or have a conversation with you because you're tired or you're very busy. And the last thing you want to do is impose yourself on other people. So there's many, many different ways of being mindful, and that's just one example of them. And a forest monk, that's what they're supposed to be practicing, you know, their meditation. So if they're not mindful, just they say, what the heck have you been doing in that forest? Even more so, the next, number 15, a forest-dwelling monk should be concentrated, let's say still. If he is not still, there'll be those who would say of him, what has this venerable forest dweller gained by his dwelling alone in the forest, doing as he likes, since he is not still? Since there'll be those who would say this of him, a forest dwelling monk should be still. Now, that tranquility of body and tranquility of mind. Because the whole idea of staying in the forest, you know, is having that freedom, you know, without too much duties to perform to the lay community, duties to anybody else, to have them the best possible situation where you can develop your mind in mindfulness and in stillness. That's why, you know, we have forest monasteries in Buddhism. We have our city center here, and it is busy, you know, for the monks when we're here. There's lots of things to do, lots of activities on the weekend, such as what we're doing now. But when you're in Serpentine, you know, the afternoons, the evenings are free, you've got plenty of free time. And so why we have that is so that the monks can actually develop, you know, their mindfulness, their stillness, their wisdom, their meditation to really get into it. That's why we have Dharmasala Nuns Monastery. That's why we don't buy it sort of in the center of town. We have it outside of town where it's nice and still. That's why we have Jhana Grove Monastery, Retreat Center, sorry. And that's a place where any of you can go, and it's very still, very peaceful. There's not much happens there. That's why it's a great place to meditate, and people understand that. So that we have forest dwelling monks, or people go to Jhana Grove, because it's a good place where you can develop your stillness and your mindfulness. And this is the same with you. If you go on a 9-day retreat and you go back,
to work and you're not still, you're not mindful, people will say of you. A jhana grove, a meditated layperson, should be still. If you are not still, there'll be those who would say of you when you go back to work, what has this person who's been to jhana grove on a retreat gained by his going to jhana grove, doing as you like, since you are not still, since you are not mindful? You've been wasting all your time and your money. So obviously you go there and you'd expect that there'd be some stillness and mindfulness back. So you have the facilities. They're saying you should use them. And also, a forest-dwelling monk or nun should be wise. If they are not wise, there'll be those who would say of them, what has a venerable forest dweller gained by his dwelling alone in a forest doing as you like, since you are not wise? Since there'll be those who would say this of them, a forest-dwelling monk should be wise. Now, what's the point otherwise? You might as well stay in the village or the town and just do service to other people. At least, you know, you're chanting for them or talking to them or doing something of use. If you're not actually developing yourself, you know, you should be a bit ashamed. So they're really making sure these forest-dwelling monks, you know, are actually producing the goods. Now, paragraph 17. This is, say, one of the reasons I like this sutta, because every now and again, in these suttas, you come across something which really sort of overturns centuries of tradition. And here is one of those. A forest-dwelling monk should apply himself to the Abhidhamma and the Abhivinaya. That's what it says, Hayadhamma and Abhivinaya there. And actually, that in this paragraph over here, there's a whole section in the original Pali which is Bhikkhu Bodhi forgot to translate. So I'm going to translate directly from the Pali on paragraph 17. A forest-dwelling monk should apply himself to the higher dharma and the higher discipline. There are those who ask a forest-dwelling monk questions on Abhidhamma and Abhivinaya. If he is not able to answer, there'll be those who say of him, what has the venerable forest dweller gained? So that's actually a different translation here, because actually it was a wrong translation of Bhikkhu Bodhi. The first one, if he does not apply himself to the higher dharma and the higher discipline, there will be those who say of him. It doesn't actually mention here that there are those who would ask the forest dwelling monks questions on Abhidhamma and Abhivinaya. So what is a venerable forest dweller gained by dwelling alone in the forest, doing as he likes, since he does not apply himself to the Abhidhamma and the Abhivinaya? Since there would be those who would say this of him, a forest-dwelling monk should apply himself to the Abhidhamma and the Abhivinaya. Now, of course, that would not mean forest monks. Everybody knows that it's in the towns you have the books. It's in the towns you have all this learning. But in the forest, you're by yourself. So what that can only mean, the Abhidhamma would mean those higher knowledge of the truth, which you get when you practice mindfulness, stillness, and wisdom. And it's a sort of extra wisdom which, you know, like an Ajahn Chah, an Ajahn Mahabua gets by spending long, long periods of time in the forest. That's the Abhidhamma, the deep teachings of the Dhamma. And it is paired with Abhivinaya, the higher discipline. And that is a discipline which comes not through control, but through letting go, where you're a peaceful person, where you can't get angry, where you don't sort of get attached to things. It's the deeper discipline which comes from realization of the stupidity of attachment, the fact there's no self in here. And that is what the Abhidhamma means, the Abhivinaya means. We got the Dhamma and the Vinaya, but the Abhi means like the deeper Dhamma, the deeper Vinaya. So we got even like five precepts. Yeah, we got eight precepts. I mean, that's the external, as you probably understood. You keep the rules, but you know, is it really natural? Is it really coming from the real source of why you should keep rules, why you should be restrained? The Abhivinaya is understanding the why, and it becomes a natural keeping of precepts, a natural keeping of rules. You know, why don't you sort of have so many possessions? Because, you know, the wisdom, it says that's stupid to have lots of possessions. The less you have, the happier you are, the freer you are. That gives you an idea of what Abhivinaya is. Now, the deeper discipline coming from realization of truths. And Abhidhamma is, you know, what those deeper truths are.
Now that's a very wonderful saying, because these days, as many of you know, the Abhidhamma became this whole philosophy, whole books of philosophy, which are just so hard to understand. That, you know, it's, as one commentator said, it just, there's only like monks can really have the time to study that. And so it gave monks this position of being like a priest, the only people who could know and possess this knowledge, which gave them the power, because they owned and possessed this knowledge. And only people only had the time to do that, all that study, which gave them an authority over others and actually separated the monks from the lay community. Now that you're the priest, you've got the knowledge, and I'm the only one who can tell you about what the Abhidhamma is. And it was, they said, just a way of elevating the Sangha. But if you have a look at it, much of it, if you do study some of it, is actually against what the Buddha taught, even, as many people said. And there's ample evidence to know it was not taught by the Buddha. I know that sometimes it's very difficult, because traditions, especially Theravada, are just so strong. And I say things like that, and people, without even checking to see if the argument is correct, without sort of looking and sort of even thinking that, you know, that myself and the other monks and the other scholars who say this are maybe onto something, say, no. What does a Western monk know about these things? You know, you don't really understand what real Buddhism is. Of course the Buddha taught the Abhidhamma. And you know the reason why? Because my teacher's teacher said so. It's our tradition. And in many countries, tradition is so strong that no one will question tradition. That's one of the nice things when you go to the West, and all of you, you've been in the West long enough, you question anybody, and well done. And keep on questioning. Yes, Michelle. Well, look, an obvious example, in the Abhidhamma, they say a person on the path to being a once returner, a path to being a non-returner, a path to being an arahat. But those path moments are just a few microseconds before the fruit. They say it's only, you know, a few microseconds, and then you actually gain the fruits of stream winning. And that is totally against his suttas there in the Sanyutta Nikaya. Anguttara Nikaya, where it says there are some people who are on the path of being a stream winner. They're on the path, and it takes them to the end of their life to get the fruit of stream winning. And they say that sometimes, because this is an important law, that you have to gain the fruit before you die, that sometimes the eon is about to finish, and you actually hold up the eon from finishing, because you have to become the fruit of stream winning before you die. They even go that far. So, I mean, that is an obvious example where the Abhidhamma is actually wrong. On the path of fruits. Yeah, okay, yeah. Well, it's actually a very standard in the suttas. The best description, again, is through a metaphor of the Buddha, and that's of the seven shipwrecked sailors metaphors, which is one of my favorite. That's from the Anguttara, the sevens. There were seven shipwrecked sailors. The first sailor, all lost their ship in the ocean. The first one goes straight down. They drown. That's the one with bad karma. The first one goes up, down, up, down, up, down, up, down, up, down, and if they get tired, they drown. That's the average person. Sometimes they got good karma, sometimes they got bad karma. They got, you know, a bit of each, but eventually they go down as well. The third sailor, he's got lots of good karma, she's got lots of good karma, and so they float on the surface, they don't drown. That's the third shipwrecked sailor. So it's a person, you've got enough good karma, enough good precepts, enough, you know, generosity you've done, enough goodness, good karma in your life, now you keep your head afloat above the difficulties of life. And the next number four is a subset of that third one. You're floating above the surface, and after a while you can see dry land. That's the stream winner. So actually you see just the end of suffering. And then the fifth shipwrecked sailor is they floated above the surface because of their good karma. They've actually seen dry land, and now they're swimming towards dry land. That's the once returner. And the non-returner, they're so close to dry land, they don't need to swim anymore. They can actually stand up in the surf. And they can feel dry land underneath. There's still a meter or a few foot of water, but they're so close, they're the non-returner, because they can now walk the rest of the way. And the last one is the arahat. They're on the dry land, sitting under a coconut tree, having a cup of tea and a muffin. But I added that bit in the end. But that's the last one. And that's a beautiful simile, because that evokes a sense of what these particular stages are. The fact that the second stage of enlightenment, the once return, is very ill-defined. It's almost automatic. If you're a stream winner, you're going to start swimming to dry land. Okay, go on, one more. Yeah. Yeah. Oh, okay. Well, that just complicates things a bit. If I've already mentioned those three worlds. Now, if you're a stream winner, so you've seen the dry land, and you don't reach a dry land by the time you die, but you've got jhanas, and so, or you just fluke a jhana at the very end, and then that means you go into the rupaloka, or maybe arupaloka, those two realms, then you're called a jhananagami. That's the Sanyutta Nikaya. A jhananagami means that because of your jhana, you're almost like get a promotion automatically from being a stream winner to being an anagami. So you go to those rupalokas, arupalokas, those jhana realms, and once that jhana sort of dissolves, then you dissolve as well. You never go back from there. That's your way out of samsara. Yeah. That's a wonderful thing to do, you say. Forget about playing around in the sensual realm. Just get these jhanas and have a very good time. You get enlightenment too. Yeah. Yeah, that's very good. That's what I was saying earlier. She was talking about spiritual materialism. That's just a good definition of that, about, I've got to keep five precepts, I've got to keep eight precepts. And it's instead of doing that, you just let go and just be selfless, disappear, have no pride, humble, no conceit, because that's letting go of the sense of self, which means you're letting go. And then the precepts become easy. And then, because when there's no one in here, there's no one to do much desiring or craving. There's no one to get angry. People call you a pig, and you look and say, who do they call a pig? There's no one in here to call a pig. And then, so you don't get upset and angry. And you find it so easy to meditate is when you disappear. The harder you try, the harder it is to attain anything. You let go and all these things happen. So these are all stages of you disappearing.
I agree with you. I agree with you there that sometimes people think they're not good enough or they can't do this. And God, they have to keep 5 precepts, they have to keep 8 precepts. And again, there's no compulsion. Yeah. Ah, yeah. It is very sad. Yeah. That's right, yeah. Purity came along. But there... Yeah. I agree with you. There's one very famous Buddhist, Sarakani, and he was a street winner, but he was also a drunkard. Looking him up in the Sangutta and the Anguttara, Sarakani. Because after he died, the Buddha actually said, oh, this guy was a street winner. And they said, how could he be a street winner? He was a drunkard. He used to take alcohol, not just a sip and not just wine with the meals, but really get into it. He said, oh yeah, he was still a street winner. And that really upset a few people. It made them think, what do you actually need to be a stream winner? But of course, precepts are good, but they should become natural, not forced on you. And I remember this story, in Thailand. This man, again, he was an alcoholic. And he went up to the monks and said, for the rains retreat, he made his resolution. He would not drink alcohol from sunrise to sunset. For 3 months. And that was just a tough thing for him to do. He'd get up early, way before sunrise, to get a few in before the sun came up. And as soon as the sun came up, he put his bottle away. And he really, really waited, you know, until the sun set, and then he could have some more to drink. But for 3 months, he kept his resolution. And now that was an example. You praise a person like that. For him, it was hard to do. You don't put him down because, yeah, you're a drunkard, no, you're not a real Buddhist, get out of the monastery. That's sort of like pride and conceit and stiffness. It has nothing to do with the Buddhism which I know. Just the compassion and encouragement, that is Buddha. Oh, yeah. It should not be forced, it should be natural. Yeah. If you can, do it. It's nice, but if you don't have to, that's the main thing. Just be compassionate and kind. Yes, Jacob. Yeah, the one on the path to being a stream winner, they call in Anguttara, it's either the Dhammanusari or the Sadhanusari, they've got actually 2 words for them. One is because they've got so much faith in the Buddha's teachings, they're going to follow their Eightfold Path. Their faith is just so strong, they're going to just follow it. And because they follow it, it's going to lead to stream winning. And the other one, their understanding, their wisdom is so strong, they understand they haven't reached the goal of stream winning yet, but they've seen everything else that the Buddha said, this is understanding, they understand the Dhamma. So they're going to follow it because of their wisdom faculty. Now, even though those are 2 separate categories, most people are a combination of both. Maybe 80% faith, 20% wisdom, or 90% wisdom, 10% faith. But you know, if it's more than 50% one way or the other, that's your Sadhanusari, or 50% the other way, Dhammanusari. And so those are before you actually reach becoming a stream winner. Sorry? Okay, it's the one who is actually floating and just remembers what the Buddha said. Oh, he said I should look over here somewhere.
or is wise enough to know, well, you know, he's heard enough sort of wise teaching, land is somewhere around. So he starts looking around instead of just getting upset or angry. Being on the path, yes. Seeing the land is actually realizing the path. Now you know the way. Okay. Go on, Daniel. Yeah. Indeed, there were people who were very, very simple, low caste people with hardly any education. They all became enlightened as well. So, obviously, it's not absolutely necessary. It was recited in the first council. You can see this in the Chula Wagga, the Vinaya Pitaka. The Upali recited the Vinaya, and Ananda recited the Pancha Nikaya. The five Nikayas. There's no mention at all about the Abhidhamma there. The Pancha Nikaya, as everybody knows, the Digha Nikaya, this is the Majjhima Nikaya, Sanyutta Nikaya, and Gutta Nikaya, and Kudaka Nikaya. Okay, so let's go further. That's the Abhidhamma in the time of the Buddha. What forest monks would know more than the town monks. 18. A forest-dwelling monk should apply himself to those liberations that are peaceful and immaterial, transcending forms. These are the Arupa Jhanas. For those who ask a forest-dwelling monk questions on the liberations that are peaceful and immaterial, transcending forms, if he does not explain, this is not apply himself, it's explain those liberations, there'll be those who would say of him, what has this venerable forest-dwelling monk gained by his dwelling alone in the forest, doing as he likes? Since he does not apply himself to these liberations that are peaceful and immaterial, transcending forms. Since there would be those who would say this of him, a forest-dwelling monk should apply himself to those arupas states, the liberations that are peaceful and immaterial, transcending forms. So again, when you're in a forest, you're supposed to be meditating and, you know, get some understanding of these states, because if people were going to ask questions on meditation, those are the people they would ask, the forest monks, because they have got the facilities, and you'd expect the people to make use of those facilities and actually get some of these deep states of meditation. Otherwise, they'd say, what's the point of staying in a forest? That's what you're there for, a forest, to get these deep states of meditation. And they say, because people will ask you questions on that, you should apply yourself. Even I was reading the other day, about even all monks, they should apply themselves to meditation. And it's a scandal that, you know, some monks, they don't know very much at all about meditation. They can't explain meditation. And sometimes they get other monks or lay people to teach meditation in their place. And that's a scandal, because people expect, you know, if you're a monk or a nun, a Buddhist, that's what you're supposed to be doing, learning meditation. If you don't know, people will ask you questions. They say, what's the purpose of being a monk or a nun if you don't learn meditation? So especially forest monks, they should be experts. Yes. In the time of the Buddha, there were those two types of possibilities for monks, and usually for the first 5 years you stay with your teacher. In other words, you wouldn't stay alone in the forest. And that was actually where you learned your basic training, you know, where you could be taught about, you know, the rules of conduct, taught about basic Dharma, taught about basic meditation. And then afterwards, off you go now into the forest. You know, you got your basic training. Sometimes monks took longer than 5 years. But, you know, it used to be a minimum of 5 years. But that rule for monks having to stay 5 years minimum with your teacher, there was an exception to that. And if the monk said, teacher, I want to go and stay alone in the forest to develop my meditation, The Buddha said, well, what can you say about that? You have to let them go. So that was what was going on there, that you get basic training, you know, in the Sangha with everybody, and then off you go by yourself. And your teacher would probably sort of advise you, yeah, you're not ready yet. Well, yeah, go now. He was talking in general about that forest monk. Yeah, well, actually, in those days that everybody knew they could become a stream winner, once return, long return, arahat, the whole idea of this was impossible these days, or some parts of society could not attain these things and some people could, that was just not there in the time of the Buddha. It was open, everybody could do, male, female, intelligent, uneducated, prostitutes, kings, anybody could. And this is one of the great opennesses about that teaching. It was embracing of everybody, not just high intelligence, not just high caste people, not just males, everybody was embraced. And they said, as long as you practice the Eightfold Path, it doesn't matter who you are, if you can practice that Eightfold Path and practice it well, you become, get these stages. Yeah, I agree. I agree with you totally. That, I mean, it was a scandal that people said jhana was impossible or enlightenment was impossible. Of course it is. I don't know either. Yeah, it's still around. But why these things happen, who knows? But now the doors of the deathless are open, Cheng. So just go through. Paragraph 19. A forest dwelling monk should apply himself to superhuman states. That's not just these idiots are flying through the air, but this is especially the, what they really mean by this is the stream winning, once returning, non returning arahat. If he cannot answer, okay, this is another Majjhima translation. If he cannot answer those questions about the superhuman states, there will be those who would say on him, what has this venerable forest dweller gained by his dwelling alone in the forest, doing as he likes, since he doesn't know the reason why he went forth? Well, that's actually the translation, and that's a brilliant translation, which is, I'm not quite sure if you've got a new edition, but in my first edition here, they missed this one out, and this was such a beautiful little saying here. I'll repeat it again. If he cannot answer those questions about the superhuman states, there'll be those who would say of him, what has this venerable forest dweller gained by his dwelling alone in the forest, doing as he likes, since he doesn't know the reason why he went forth? And this is when the next week, we're doing a novice ordination, a seminary ordination here. And when you see that, you actually hear Sabbadukha Nisarana Nibbana Sachi Karanataya Kaza Wanga Hetawa Papajang Deita Me Bante. I've done so many ordinations, I know that off by heart. What that means is, please give me the yellow robes, let me go forth. Sabba Dukkha Nisarana, for the freedom from all suffering, for the attainment of Nibbana. And that's what we chant, everybody chants at their ordination, their first ordination going forth. They say, why you're going forth? Sabba Dukkha Nisarana, the freedom from all suffering, Nibbana Satchikaranataya, for the attainment, the realization of Nibbana. That's why we become monks. That's why we become nuns. That's why we go forth. That's why you become a Buddhist. That's why you come here. So if this monk is living in the forest
And he can't ask the questions about the stages of enlightenment. He's forgot why he went forth. That's the reason why he went forth, to understand these things. Stream meaning once returning, non-returning, arahant. If he doesn't know these things, he's forgot why he went forth. That's a lovely little answer. I remember actually a long time ago, this was Ajahn Chakkaro, when this was about 30 years ago now. He was the abbot over in Thailand for a couple of years. And I remember just being with him as his attendant. One of the monks was coming up and saying he was having trouble with sexual fantasies. And the monk, Ajahn Chakkaro, said, "Well, you should remember why you went forth. What are you here for?" And it's actually a very nice answer, because I always remember that. You know, look, you're not here just to sort of indulge and just to play around. You're here to become enlightened. So remember that. Why you went forth. So you remember why you went forth, what you're doing this for. And then you might actually understand some of these things. Yes, Michelle. Yeah, that was number 18. Yeah. We did mention that, the arupa states. Okay. So that's again, the forest dwelling monks. These are supposed to be the great meditators because they got much better opportunities. They got all the peace of the forest, all this time, not that many distractions. So they said you should be applying yourself to these states. So when people ask you questions about them, you should be able to answer them. Otherwise, they'll say, what's the point of being in a forest? You've been wasting time. And the same in number 19, about further than that, the stages of enlightenment. You should be able to answer questions on these to people, even much more so than the town monks, because that's your expertise. That's why you're in the forest. You're asking a question that, from what you've been hearing here, you see, I heard, oh, it's just as good as in the past to become enlightened. It's not as good in the past. I was just saying it's still possible today. You know, the doors are still open. Unfortunately, that even Ajahn Chah, and even less so me, now we can't speak like a Buddha spoke. We can't teach like a Buddha taught. I mean, that was a great teacher. That was powerful, having actually a Buddha teach. That's really amazing. So that's, you know, getting the best teacher in the world. And sometimes if you go to university, you go to school, and you get these top teachers, then everybody gets the first class grade A's because of the teacher. So, yeah, you can still sort of get first class and A's and whatever else, but sort of, you know, the teachers are not as good as in the time of the Buddha. It's still possible, so we're not saying it's not possible, but, you know, the standard of teaching has gone down. And I hang my head in shame, but I can't do much about that. Okay, last paragraph, paragraph 20. When this was said, Venerable Mahamoggallana asked the Venerable Sariputta, Venerable Sariputta, should these things be undertaken and practiced only by a forest-dwelling monk or by a town-dwelling monk as well? And Venerable Mahamoggallana, these things should be undertaken and practiced not only by a forest monk, but by a town-dwelling monk as well. So, yeah, but I mean, you'd expect much more from a forest-dwelling monk. They should still be undertaken by a town-dwelling monk. Now, that was an interesting sutta because, number one, it did show that even in the time of the Buddha, there was those monks staying in town and those monks staying in the forest. And throughout history, that actually, in history in Burma and also in Thailand, these are countries I know, and in Sri Lanka, yeah, they did have to have administrations of the monks, but not in these two sects. They had like the sect who looked, the administration which looked after the affairs of the forest monks, the Aranyawasi administration, and the ones who looked after the city monks. And those were actually the two different administrations. There wasn't two different sects. It was just, these were two groups of monks which with different needs. And that was there in the early days. So these were from the very beginning. And you can see when I mentioned the training, initial training, in the sort of the towns, we can get your basic training, and then off you go to the forest. Yes, Dania. The purpose for the so-called city monastery, again, they weren't really in the cities, they were just outside, but they were close to the city, within a kilometer, within walking distance, basically. And they were there because not only for the training of the monks, for their material support, and also for teaching the lay community. So if all the monks were in the forest, it would be too far away, and basically no one would listen to the Dhamma, no one would hear the Dhamma, the thing would actually would just disappear. So it's same why we've got a city center here, why we've got forest monasteries. So the city center is where we teach, and then forest monasteries is where the monks and the visitors practice. Yeah, big teaching. That's right, yeah. Except for the later bhikkhuni monasteries, because in that time, the bhikkhunis, they were looked upon in society as like free women. So there were some scallywag men would actually rape them. And there's just too many had actually experienced that terrible thing. And as a result of that, the Buddha said, no, the bhikkhunis should live much closer to the city. And that's actually with Dhammasara Monastery. That was, you know, I checked that out. Is that a forest monastery? It's a big forest there. But I checked out on Google, and actually it's from the nearest Nansat to the nearest lay building. And I checked it out, and it was actually less than a kilometer. So it's technically not a forest monastery according to the Vinaya, because it says in the Vinaya that the bhikkhunis can't stay in a forest monastery. So I got them out on a loophole. A lot of monasteries for the bhikkhunis. Yeah, there seem to be quite a few monasteries for the bhikkhunis, because there are many bhikkhunis around, and you actually read their stories in the Terigata. So to answer that question, I tell you, just go and get from the library or sit in the library, it's nice and air-conned, and get out their book, Terigata, the verses of the enlightened women. And so heaps of them. That's actually very inspiring. So, yeah, they're in the city, but they're also over there in the forest as well. Okay, so there we go. That's the Gulisani Sutta. Hasn't been taught yet. So maybe you can ask the question personally afterwards. So that's 69. Has some interesting stuff about the forest tradition and also the city tradition, how they work together, how they should respect one another. And that's really, really important. And how that forest monks, they should make sure, forests, if you stay in the forest, even if you go to Jhana Grove, make sure that you don't waste the opportunities over there. So that you should be able to be more restrained, more humble, and don't get into any spiritual materialism. I'm a better meditator than you are. You don't even meditate, you're not a real Buddhist. And don't do things like that. And also make sure that, you know, you understand the restraint. As Rodney said very well, don't make restraint making you miserable, because that's not real restraint. That's just control and fear. And forest monks, they shouldn't be able to know about meditation, especially the deep meditations and the other states, especially of enlightenment, because that's the reason why you went forth, and that's what forests are there for. So if you're not doing those things there, that sometimes you're wasting your time. Okay. So, that's the Gulisani Sutta. Now we can pay respects to Buddha, Dhamma, Sangha. And if you have your personal questions, please come up.
Arahaṃ Sammā Sambuddho Bhagavā Buddhaṃ Bhagavantaṃ Abhivādhemi. so akato bhagavata dhammo dhammang namassami supatipanno bhagavato savaka sangho sanghang namami.